began, we started with the idea that, first of all, that, you know, we've got these two great Western New York cultural institutions, and Louis Brachos, who is on the, who is the director of the Albright Knox Museum, is on my advisory board, and we were talking about what could we do to you know, generate in here to something together. You know, it's kind of crazy that Albright Knox and Chautauqua aren't doing anything together. And I had this, I teach in Washington, D.C., and I take my graduate students down to the National Gallery every, you know, a couple of times a semester, and I have them look up online the work that they would like to have pulled out of the vaults. And we go down and pull works on paper, and they give a little talk about it, and then they put it back in the vaults. And Louis Albright also has a big collection of works on paper, and we thought this would be a really terrific way to get some of the work that people don't have the opportunity to see out of Albright Knox, in a way to kind of get Albright and Chautauqua working together. And I, as an artist, am really much more interested in the way artists think than in what their signature work is. So, and I think you see that a lot more clearly in an artist's drawings and works on paper than in their big stamped signature museum pieces, which we're mostly familiar with. If you've been to a museum, you've seen most of these, a contemporary museum, you've seen most of these artists. And so then the other reason for doing it was we noticed that people just, and this is not something unique to Chautauqua, this is actually, you know, kind of fairly American experience, people tend not to really understand abstract painting. And there's a language that's involved. As an artist, you know, you stand in front of a Jackson Pollock and being enthralled and mystified by this incredible painting, the person next to me will say, "My kid could have done that." And so part of that has to do with not really understanding what's happening. And part of what I say in this statement is that one of the most one really interesting thing about really the two major contributions that America made to 20th century culture, world culture, the contributions that came from America and disseminated throughout the world, the two major contributions were pretty much jazz and abstract expressionism. There were other places where you know, there were other things that, you know, you can talk about film, but that was an international thing to begin with, and it was a two-way street. But these two things were the first cultural forms that really emigrated from America around the world. And they went around the world like a shot around the world. And so I thought it was very appropriate to do a show like that at Chautauqua. I think that, and I wanted to do it also to sort of inform people a little more about what abstract painting is. It's like, one of the things about our culture is that I think it has to do with, unlike living in Europe, where there's art everywhere that you, I spend a lot of time living in Italy, and the smallest little town has, you know, a Caravaggio hanging around the, you know, around the wall in the rectory, you know, and a Piero della Francesca. There's this, they mine art the way we mine coal here. And so art is so much a part of the experience there that there's a kind of an awareness of the visual language that is just part of the heritage. You know, I mean, how can you live in the country that Florence is in and not have that be part of your language? You know? But what we have in America is a different kind of history, which is about space and about rawness, raw wilderness, about youth. It's a much younger country, and we don't have that kind of layered history. So we have a different kind of understanding. We do have music, and so I make the comparison to jazz. We, as children, you know, our mothers sing to us, we've got the radio playing, we hear music all our lives. So by the time you're 21, you've had 21 years of ambient instruction in music, whether it's formal or not, and you can hear Beethoven, and whether you like it or not, you can say, "I think I could appreciate that," regardless. But you could probably, most Americans could count on one hand the number of times they've been to a museum looking at contemporary art by the time they're 20. So there's a difference in terms of the awareness level. So I think that's one of the reasons that it's important to kind of understand this in terms of its sort of parallel relationship to jazz, you know, which also begins with an understructure, but it's very much improvised around.
John, so,
yeah.
When did abstract art appear on the scene?
It actually appeared earlier than this. The first abstract American artist was Arthur B. Carles, who was the father of Mercedes Matter, who was one of my teachers, and he was a Philadelphia painter. And that would have been in the very early 20th century. But America in the early 20th century was the provinces. The center of the art world at that time was Paris. Most of the earlier artists in this grouping, there are variations, but the earlier artists, Franz Kline, Lee Krasner, Jasper John, Sam Francis, Philip Gustav, Hans Hoffmann, they are the product of World War II, the immigration out of Europe, and whether they emigrated from Europe. This group were the Americans who were here, but the art world shifted to New York during the war, and shortly after the war. And so that's when abstraction became a significant factor, which would have been the 40s to the 60s, mm-hmm. when it became sort of the center of the art world. It was also the time that you had this group of artists who were living downtown New York. Most of what happened in terms of this huge movement, what happened between 8th Street and 14th Street, 6th Avenue and 1st Avenue. Now there are people from other places, but that was sort of the epicenter for the move to abstraction and the move to abstract expressionism.
Did it have any relation to the Bauhaus work that was going on in Germany?
No, except to react against it. Uh-huh. The Bauhaus was European. They called that group the Bauhaus, the Surrealists, the people, the ones who came during the war. They referred to them as the Redcoats. And these artists were downtown working, making major breakthroughs in terms of where the cutting edge in art was, growing out of an earlier world, but distinctly American. And it was the first time that had happened, where they weren't saying, we're going to be like Bauhaus or Surrealists or whatever.
Brand new.
And they actually met at a place called, first they started at the Waldorf Cafeteria on 6th Avenue and 8th Street. And they would meet one or two nights a week and have discussions about things that they felt were critical to art and things that we might not really like, the significance of the horizontal. Is that a landscape? Is that an abstract mark? Is that plastic? Is it a division? Is it a connection? And have really intense philosophical discussions about these things. And they wouldn't let the Redcoats come to the discussions. And the woman who was married to the person who organized those discussions, his name was Philip Pavia, and the people in the discussions were people like Willem de Kooning and Jackson Pollock and Lee Krasner, Hans, a lot of these people. And the woman who wrote the essay for the catalog for this show was married to Pavia, so she has some very interesting insights into that whole time period and what that meant. Jump in with any other questions, anybody else.
I find it always interesting if you squint your eyes a little bit when you're looking at abstract art, because then you get more intense shapes of, if you look at black and white one, then you can really see the motion in the white, and it's all going diagonally.
That's a good read on things. So you see, a lot of this is something that's very intuitive and very found, but that's no different than music. Like I said, nobody says to me, people will look at and it's fine to say, recognize that, what is that supposed to be, or what does that represent, or it looks like such and such to me. But we don't do that when we listen to, we don't say, what does Beethoven mean?
Right.
Well, it's sort of you let it, you respond to it. You let it envelop you. You have a language to respond to the Beethoven or to the Charlie Parker or to whoever it is that you like. There's a certain place where interpretation is dependent on the effort of the viewer and the willingness of the viewer to engage in a search for understanding. One of the things I like to say about education I put in a little note downstairs about Florence Norton, who we have dedicated this whole summer to. All of our programs this summer. For those of you who know Florence, she was so much a part of the evolution of the visual arts here at Chautauqua. She was in the early 50s, the voice, worked to get worked with the art school director then, Remington Arthur, to get a gallery on the campus of Chautauqua. Anyway, I always think of her as like someone who thinks along the lines of education being a chance on taking something that you don't know, a chance on trusting something you don't know, and that's what it takes to kind of begin to understand some of this. It's not something that I can tell you, I can explain to you what this painting in particular means any more than I can explain to someone who doesn't have an understanding of classical music what a particular artist means. But there are very interesting things. This one, for instance, the Guston over here, which a lot of people might have difficulty understanding, why is that significant? First of all, you have to think that this is Philip Guston, who was one of my teachers. And first you have to understand that it's a thought. He's thinking. He's in the studio. He's not thinking about putting this up on a wall, first of all. And he's thinking about rhythms. And he's thinking about, he's thinking about notes. And he's thinking, and he may be thinking about the landscape. But it's a thought process kind of drawing that works into what Guston's paintings become. It also is labeled for Morty. Morty is Morton Feldman, who was a very important avant-garde composer in the 50s. That's the other thing about this generation, is that unlike what happened post-50s, when the art schools all moved into the universities, and this generation were people who were, you've got, Morton Feldman and Philip Glass and John Cage were all contemporaries, very tight contemporaries, along with Guston, and you've got Philip Guston. Feldman, in fact, became the dean of an art school at one point. So you've got Guston talking to Morty Feldman, who's talking to Philip Glass, and Guston's best friend is Philip Roth, and there's this inner, and Frank O'Hara is writing poetry, and there are all these people. We had one of them here recently. He was a poet laureate. 45 years ago, he died after that. I can't think of his name, but this interaction between, literature and poetry and art and music was at one point so connected, and now it's also segmented because of what the way the world is structured now. There's so much information out there; it's hard to take. When these people were painting, the art world was tiny. Everybody knew everybody else. Half of them had lived together at one point or another, and it was, it was only a couple of hundred people, and it's a huge industry now. But this is the period of time when it was born in this country, that shift out of Europe to the United States. So I thought that was a significant thing to do for Chautauqua. And what we're doing with the series of exhibitions is, we received a grant from the Oshai Foundation to do three exhibitions, and so I'm going to do it. This is the first, which is kind of an introduction to abstraction, beginning with someone who sort of predates this world in Milton Avery, but you can see abstraction happening in his work, clearly, and up to someone, he was on the front page of the New York Times last week, Cy Twombly, because he just passed away. And back there, Cy Twombly. And this is the kind of introduction to that generation of artists that is so significant in the history of American art. Next year, we'll do a show a somewhat later period, you know, the 60s to maybe the 80s, somewhere in there. And then the third show will be contemporary abstraction.
Don, what kinds of things were art critics saying about these
they were saying
as they were coming out?
Nothing. Zero.
So
they didn't exist. When they in the 40s, when this was happening, you had Clement Greenberg talking about Pollock, you know, you had a few people talking, but these people were not the major figures that they became. And when much of this work was being done, it's always something about the whole idea of making art, making something that's original, as opposed to performing something we already understand. When these artists were painting, when you had de Kooning and Franz Kline and Gustin and Pollock and all these American artists working, the most famous artist in America was Ben Shahn, you know, and the most important artist in America was Ben Shahn, who was, you know, it's in terms of the history of things in this country, nowhere nearly as significant as these artists have become. The same thing could be said, you know, when the Impressionists were, when Cézanne was painting and you know, Monet and Manet, and the most important artists in Europe, while Cézanne, Manet, Monet, the whole group of painting, was an artist by the name of Puvy de Chavannes, who, you know, artists might know, but it's the significant thing, you know, Cézanne's work, what they said about Cézanne's work, one line from one of the major critics was, this is the work of a drunken privy cleaner. But we are, like everybody in this room can look at Cézanne now after 100 and some odd years and say, I get that makes sense to me, but we've had 100 years to learn about it and understand it. Understand that the general public, you know, the ordinary person at that time thought Cézanne was just garbage. They also thought Beethoven was a noisemaker, you know. What's he just pounding on the keys? You know, you can see that all the way through. So nothing was being written about this. Very little was being written.
When did things start getting written?
Late 50s. Well, the first big thing was, you know, inside the art world, there was, which was a small entity, there was a general recognition that Jackson Pollock was an incredibly important painter who was at the forefront of, de Kooning said he broke the ice. And he opened the door to abstraction in this country. So inside the art world, it was understood. But the first big thing that happened was in the mid-50s, like 56, 57, somewhere in the mid-50s, Life magazine had a photo with Jackson Pollock on the cover and said, is this America's greatest living artist? And that's when it opened up, is around that was the first widely disseminated image.
Do you know what any of these artists said about their own work?
Oh, yeah. It's hard to, I mean, let's start with, this is another one, I'll pick one that's hard to understand, the Hoffman, which is the three colors over there. You have to understand that this is basically, again, thinking process. Hoffman's whole thing was about, and he was the teacher for a lot of them. He was sort of he was a little older than pretty much everybody else, and actually became the teacher for much of the New York School or Abstract Expression, that group. But he was about, you know, sort of trying to essentialize what the language of art is. So he would, and so in some sense, this is almost like a metaphor for what he did as an artist, and trying to explain what art does. Like, there's an essay he wrote called The Search for the Real in the Visual Arts, where he talks about the way that colors relate to one another, and the way that they pulse in terms of one another. The way that red sits behind that yellow, because of the amount, you know, visually, if we had little other information, we had to say, where is that red in relation to the yellow? We would tend to see it behind the yellow. It's just a physiological fact. Whether, you know, I mean, if you're not seeing that, it's more because your brain's controlling that. Physiologically, the red sits behind the yellow in the way that we see. And so you get this. And then what Hoffman would do would, you know, he would try to counter that, like maybe make the yellow this much bigger so that it would start doing this, and try to make it come, so that it would come alive and start to pulse. And that's called push-pull. And it was a big thing that Hoffman articulated that everybody from Raphael to Degas used and understood. That you know, certain colors recede, certain colors come forward. So he talked a lot about that. He talked a lot about tension, about creating a kind of tension. So this is about creating a kind of tension, making, on the one hand, the color goes back, but if I make that yellow bigger, it might start to do this, and you start to create a tension. And he said that things that are alive have tension. Things that are dead have no tension.
And your eyes jump from one to another.
And you couldn't stay. You would have to move back and forth. Lee was somebody I knew, Krasner, and just to give you one thing that she said, do any of you know Lee Krasner? Know her work, Lee Krasner? She had this point. She was married to Jackson Pollock, and a much younger artist than Pollock, quite a bit younger. And at one point felt very doubtful about her earlier work. And this is to give you one thing that you don't get out of the text, but she had this period where she was doing collages. And what she did was she went into her studio and took the earlier work that she felt was not successful, and she just cut it all up and started making collages out of it. And they were fairly well received. And in the 70s making collages, and I had her in my studio, and I was talking about cutting some work up, and she said, don't cut it up too fast. She said, wait at least 5 years, because you can't really see it until you're far enough away from it, which I thought was an interesting insight. I mean, I take that to mean, like, I think I cut some stuff up I shouldn't have cut up. Avery? He's really kind of the old guard in the show.
Okay.
So he comes out of an earlier generation. It'd be like Avery, Arthur Dove, Charles Birchfield, John Maron, of earlier American painters coming out of the landscape. I think one of the interesting things about this, and this is just my take on it, and I've had many long conversations. A friend of mine and I want to write about this. We just have never gotten around to it. But she's a landscape painter. But we both think that that abstract expressionism could never have happened in another country. And it has to do with the landscape. And I find it very interesting that you've got artists looking back at Avery and Birchfield and Dove and Maron. And kind of seeing the beginnings of that abstraction, and that their abstraction comes out of the landscape. And part of the reason I feel like American abstraction happened had to do with this kind of expansive space that we have. That our history is not that vertical European history. Our history is the landscape. Mm-hmm. Our history is the space. You know, it's a very different kind of experience. So I think I don't see that painting happening at that time in Europe. I see it happening in the 50s in Europe. Not with that energy. What you might, now it's Cy Twombly back here, who's not quite as aggressive, but actually much more delicate with his mark making, and in a way considered, but he's delicate. This is aggressive and raw. That's got the same kind of idea, but it's delicate and he's living in Italy. He moved to Italy. You know, he's coming to New York, but he's living in Italy. So, and there is a different kind of sensual nature to the way he makes a mark as opposed to the way that she makes a mark. That relates to that kind of space, I think. Who else is back there? I'd like to stop me, because it's so unlike Gottlieb, but so like Gottlieb, this print, this black and white. You get this sense of space, of landscape.
criticism versus relativism arguments.
From that period? Yeah, sure, that's really interesting, because I teach now. And I studied with this generation. You know, this generation was, nobody looked at them, and then they became the only thing. And basically, you know, by 1965, or no, by 1960, it started to shift late, it's very quickly, but there was a period in there where if you were not painting abstract expressionist paintings, you were, you know, persona non grata. You just couldn't do it. You couldn't paint. Couldn't paint the landscape. You certainly couldn't paint the landscape. But you couldn't even paint representational. So they became like the truth. It's an interesting kind of thing. We could find some metaphors in the larger world about this. Like they're really exciting, and then they become the truth, and then all of a sudden it's really not so great. So the next generation then reacts against them. And so you went from this heavy, you know, this stuff, you see it being born out of the middle of the 20th century. I mean, this is not lightweight. This is about, you know, you realize the world is in chaos at the time these artists are painting. And they're not making political paintings, but that's just the nature, you know, it's just what comes out. But then the reaction to this was pop art, you know, which, you know, paintings of bubblegum machines and pastries and paintings of, you know, storefronts, and super realist paintings of car window reflections, you know, so, and that sort of took over then. And then after that, then you had minimalism, and then you had conceptual, and this lasted about 10 years probably, and then the next movement lasted about 6 years, and the next one about 3 years. Then by the late 80s, I was coming to Chautauqua in the summer and going back to New York, and it was a different art world when I got back. They were happening so fast, the movements. But what's, so it's now that just doesn't exist. Yeah. There is no absolutism.
So what's now?
Nothing. I mean, everything and nothing. I mean, it depends on how you want to look at it. There is no ism. There hasn't been an ism for, close to 20 years, I would say. That's what it's going to be, because the world is so global. And so you could look at, I think it's a great time for students to be artists, you know. It's a great time to be an artist. You can work representationally, you can work whatever form you want. There is an audience out there. At the same time, there is no big audience. It's just like, you know, just like the information. I mean, it's almost like we're in the Middle Ages. Like we've got, you know, our realists here at Spoleto, and then we've got the other guys over.